Okay, and welcome back. It is, unfortunately, receding into the mists of time, that being World War II. One of the organizations that has been in the forefront of trying to bring history, as we know it, into accord with the facts as they were and are, is the Institute for Historical Review, led by Mark Weber, who is an extraordinary historian and scholar in his own right, and the organization has a library of provocative and, I think, very important books for people to read and consider. Understand that when wars are fought, usually the bankers are behind it. The villains are often not the villains as they are portrayed, either during the wars or after. We saw that with Saddam Hussein. We've seen it so many times throughout history. The winners write the story, and the stories become even more corrupted and perverted over time as they make their way through the scholastic curricula of various countries in the Western world and the world in general, depending on the conflict under discussion. There is an awful lot going on the planet today, which makes, in the minds of many who still even bother to think or have the time to think about such things, World War II even more obscure. But in a way, World War II is the very bedrock and foundation upon which today's crises are unfolding, as was World War I and its outcome and so-called peace, the bedrock foundation of what happened that we know of as World War II. Are we being played like a cheap fiddle by certain vested special interest international monetary groups? Yes. Is this new? No. Is it going to continue? Probably. But what we have is the human element to consider tonight with Mark Weber. The issue of Allied, American, British, and French, genocide and war crimes against not only the German civilian population, but Germans in uniform. And then after the war as well, because it didn't stop with the end of hostilities in 1945. It continued on into the early 1950s and even beyond that. The number of German civilians liquidated in genocide during and after the war. We can talk just about after the war if you want. The estimates range anywhere from 6 to 8 to 10 million. We don't know for sure. But what we do know is that after World War II ended, the Americans, the British, and the French, and others, certainly Joseph Stalin, not the least of which, and his machine, were involved with the slaughter of millions and millions of men, women, and children. And they were German by ethnic heritage. We're going to talk about a little bit of that tonight with Mark Weber. Welcome back to the program, Mark.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
It's my pleasure. And what you do at the Institute of Historical Review is remarkable. I think the books there in your library are, well, they're on a lot of banned book lists, shall we say that? Because there are certain people out there who don't want us to examine history and make our own decisions. They want us to believe what they're putting out for us to believe. And anyway, you do a wonderful job there with your staff. Institute for Historical Review. You can click on Mark's name and go right there, browse around, and if you find anything of interest, have at it. If not, I'm glad you stopped by. It's ihr.org. All right, so World War II. Let me just start off by saying that the bombing of Germany by the Anglo-American military was not primarily aimed at German industrial targets. There were some cursory lip service paid to that early on and some raids. But generally speaking, the bombing raids that obliterated much of German urban area during the war was directed at the German civilian population. That's being admitted now. This was a case of sheer, unadulterated genocide during the war. Correct?
Well, in many ways, it was more admitted even back in the 40s or 50s than it is today. Because in the context of superheated context of the war years itself and just after, officials were even willing to admit that the goal and the purpose of the Allied American and British bombing campaign against Germany, especially in the final year of the war, was largely just to kill as many German civilians as possible, to terrorize the population. We hear a lot about terrorism, and in fact our president talks about a war on terrorism, a global war on terrorism. But it's interesting to note that the internal documents by the American and British leaders, even Churchill, acknowledged that the Allied bombing campaign, especially in the final months of the war, was a terror campaign. And it was a word even used by Winston Churchill in one of the memos that was written just after the devastating and horrific bombing campaign against the city of Dresden in February of 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this bombing campaign, the number of German civilians who died as a result was estimated more than 500,000. Usually estimates are about 600,000,
right,
mostly women and children who were literally holocausted, that is, killed in fire and in suffocation in this horrific way.
Right. Kurt Vonnegut, of course, wrote about this in Slaughterhouse 5.
Right. And for many Americans, the movie Slaughterhouse 5 or the book is the closest they come to an understanding about this. But the details of this are well known, but not the full story or the perspective on it is not really emphasized. That is, no one expects that anybody, that allies are supposed to atone for it or make up for it, or there's to be endless replication or repeating of the narration of the thing. Instead, we're supposed to concentrate, of course, on other victims of World War II.
Right.
But really, the important thing is to see history as part of a larger story and a larger perspective, and to avoid the wartime propaganda, which always emphasizes our side is good, the other side is bad.
And the simple fact that people are people is never mentioned, of course.
Well, of course. And that's the most horrific thing of all, and is that war is a great, terrible, terrible thing for so many people, whether it's Japanese, Chinese, Germans, Poles, Russians, Jewish, or whatever.
Doesn't matter. So I've always been an equal opportunity mourner, shall we say, for victims of violent death. I don't care who they are. They're all equal in my eyes. This issue of, in February 1945, decimating Dresden, killing over 500,000 innocent civilians.
Half a million is the figure all the war years. The number of deaths in Dresden alone vary from 35,000 up to, say, 200,000.
Mm-hmm.
But it's particularly egregious, though, because in February of 1945...
The war is over.
The war is not only over. The military bombing was carried out just solely for the purpose of just killing lots of people.
As many as possible.
There was no direct military...
No strategic aim at all, except to destroy human life.
There was no strategic aim. Part of the aim, as even brought out in the series that's now being shown on public television about World War II, was to impress the American Allied leader, Joseph Stalin, the leader of the Soviet Union during that time. But, in fact, yes, it's true. The war is receding into the past. But in many ways, World War II is the defining war of our time, of our century. It's for many Americans, it's the good war. It's the war that rallied the country, and people look on it as, and rightly so, as the defining war. And that's underscored by the impact of this multi-part series now being shown on public television by Ken Burns and his collaborator.
How are you impressed with it so far?
Well, I think it's good, and in general it's good, because the more people know, however slanted it might be, the better, because better to have some information that people can learn from.
Mm-hmm.
But the strength and the weakness of the series is the same. That is, it's a look at World War II from a very American perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the series, there's a focus on three American cities, one in Wisconsin, one in Mobile, Alabama, and a city, I think, in Massachusetts, and families and people from that point of view. But it's important to remember that as important and as great as the American role in the war was, that the great bulk of the fighting wasn't involved the United States. It was really involving and taking place on the Eastern Front between the German forces and their allies and the Soviet forces on the other hand.
90% of the German military fought in the Eastern Front. That's where World War II really occurred. It wasn't Normandy. It wasn't in Western Europe. It was a war between Zionist Bolshevism, murderous, wretched Bolshevism, which had slaughtered tens of millions of people by that time already under Joseph Stalin, and Germany.
Well, the American troops did not land in Normandy in June 1944 until less than a year before the war was already over. The war was really essentially decided before American troops even landed in Normandy.
Correct. Stalingrad.
And, yeah. Right. Stalingrad had already taken place, and the Germans had been forced to give up huge territories already in the east, so that five-sixths of the German divisions were destroyed on the eastern front, not in North Africa, Italy, or France.
Had the Germans been able to divert even one or two divisions to the west, Normandy would have been repelled in all likelihood, even without air parity or anything of the sort. They almost did it without any. And that's just a remarkable military fact of the war. Okay, and by the way, many of the people in the German army on the Western Front opposing the Allies were not actually Germans at all. They were volunteers from many countries, Romania, Sweden, all sorts of volunteers and non-Germans. So people don't know that either. It's a remarkable book out called The War on the Eastern Front. Leon DeGrelle wrote it, and you should read that sometime. Hi, back with Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review, IHR.org. Okay, Mark, go ahead, please. Fascinating.
Well, we were talking a little bit about the series it's on and its strengths and weaknesses. I mean, it's important, and the series does a very good job of showing World War II as Americans lived it, and there's a lot of emphasis on the human element in that regard, and that's very good. But again, inherently, it's unable to tell the story in a larger context. There's nothing about the Eastern Front. There's nothing about, or almost nothing about, the Soviet role in the war. There's a very heavy emphasis, of course, on the Pearl Harbor and the Americans against Japan and so forth. But the larger story is this, and that is to get over and to understand that the World War II is not a simple conflict between good guys and bad guys. America's most important, its greatest allies in World War II were, first, the British Empire, mm-hmm. which held the largest empire in world history. The largest empire in world history, that means hundreds of millions of people held under British rule against their will, on the one hand, and the Soviet Union. At that mm-hmm. time, the world's most grotesque tyranny of the time was the other more great American ally of the Second World War.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to say that this is a war for freedom and democracy when the two greatest allies of the United States mm-hmm. Fighting in that war represented for tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people not freedom, but oppression and tyranny.
That's a very important point. Yeah, to even consider for a minute that the American government was in bed with Joseph Stalin, the butcher, and giving him American lend-lease by the billions and billions of dollars, which, of course, was never repaid. It ought to make your stomach turn, folks.
Today, the United Nations, what we call the United Nations, first began during World War II itself as the coalition of the Allied powers. That was what originally was called the United Nations. The United Nations organization was set up in 1945 as a way to keep permanent the hegemony, the domination of the world by the Soviet Union and the United States as a permanent feature. Hopefully, they thought, forever. It wasn't an object of liberation. It was an object of to sustain permanent power by the United States and the Soviet Union. And the United States government and Franklin Roosevelt fully wanted, expected, worked for a permanent alliance with the Soviet Union and dominating the world through the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
So the Allied leaders, Stalin, Churchill, and Roosevelt, meeting at Tehran in Iran and mm-hmm. then in Crimea
in Yalta,
were able to decide the fate of millions of people around the world with no consultation or concern about right. their own desires or wants right. or feelings.
Right, none whatsoever. So the German civilian population suffered horrendously during the war. And
well, yes, but not only did the German population suffer tremendously during the war, but the focus, I think, this evening is on how horrific the treatment of the Germans was after the war.
That's right.
By the victorious Allies.
That's what we're going to focus on.
By the Soviet Union, by the British, by the French, especially by the Soviets. Very few people understand, for example, that alone, massive rape of German women, not just German women, also in Hungary
But they're talking about millions here.
Millions of women were brutally raped, and many men killed who tried to protect women.
Many of the women were killed, too, after they were raped.
Many women were killed as well, yes. I mean, that alone constitutes the largest single mass rape of women in history.
In military force. And this was done by the advancing Soviet hordes who were urged to do that, to rape and destroy everything German that they could come into contact with. And they were, who was the lunatic madman Bolshevik who was urging them to kill?
The most prominent Soviet propagandist of the time was Ilya Ehrenberg, a Jewish propagandist who had spent years living in the West, and he was very highly, treated in a very friendly way by much of the American media, even when he died. And although he was a faithful servant of the Soviet machine and was responsible for some of the most horrific propaganda, urging mm-hmm. Soviet soldiers just to brutally kill as many people as possible, he finally died, I think in the 1970s or 80s. When he finally died, everyone was surprised that although he had been a very faithful propagandist for the Soviet regime, mm-hmm. he asked to be buried in Israel. But anyway, yes, his propaganda, in fact, was so horrific that he was told to tone it down in the final months of the war because the Soviets were concerned that propaganda like this would make it more difficult to carry out their occupation policy in Germany and the rest of Europe at the end of the war.
Precisely, which is another reason to try to understand how the Soviets continued to promote the Nazi regime as the worst thing in history long after the war was dead, to keep people diverted from watching the solidifying of the crush that the Russians put on Eastern Europe that Roosevelt gave away, basically.
Well, the Soviet Union, the United States and the American government could not very well be critical of what the Soviets did in Eastern Europe while at the same time having praised the Soviet Union in the years during the war.
Exactly.
If the Soviet Union was such a wonderful state that the United States, that it deserved unstinting support from the U.S. government during the war, it became very hypocritical and difficult to, at the same time, just right after the war, tell everybody that the Soviet Union was bad. But what happened is once Germany was eliminated, once the war was won, the interests of the United States and the Soviet Union diverged because their primary interest during the war itself, of course, was simply winning the war.
Well, ask if we could talk to General Patton, he'd tell us.
Well, of course, many Americans felt, of course, that a great mistake had been made, including General Patton, who felt that the whole alliance with the Soviet Union had been a big mistake.
Yeah, well, Patton knew, and that's why he was murdered. He had to take him out. He was far too popular. Murder, an intrinsic part of the globalist control mechanism in our own American geopolitical milieu, as it were, knows no bounds. They'll take people away and get rid of them anytime they want. Be right back with Mark Weber in just a couple minutes. I'm talking with Mark Weber about what happened to the German civilian population and a large portion of the members of the German military after the war ended, which was April 1945. Okay, Mark, what happened? First of all, and I remember getting from the IHR years and years ago, James Bakke's book, Other Losses, which opened my eyes to horrors that 99% of Americans will probably never hear about.
But, right. James Bakke is a Canadian writer, and his book, Other Losses, was a startling revelation for many people about the mistreatment of German prisoners of war by Americans, and to a lesser extent by British, at the end of the conflict, and especially the just horrific treatment of very large numbers of German POWs in these large camps along the Rhine River. A couple of things. I mean, there has been some revision of James Bakke's data. I think that some of the figures are somewhat inflated, but the basic point he's making is a valid and one that stands up under scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
But for one thing, there's a lot of talk right now about whether the United States is doing things legally or illegally in Guantanamo or whether prisoners should be treated this way or that way. One of the most striking things that happened right after the war is that the Americans declared all the German POWs under their control no longer POWs, but as a, but gave them this new legal definition of disarmed enemy forces. And what that meant was, suddenly, all these German POWs were no longer under the protection of the Geneva Convention and the International Red Cross, and could and were, in many, many cases, treated in this very horrific way with no legal protection. This declaration alone was simply illegal. It's as if, if comparably, POWs under German control during World War II had simply been declared they're no longer POWs, and they could be tortured or mistreated or whatever.
Given the Guantanamo treatment.
Given the Guantanamo treatment or whatever, yes. I mean, but see, we still don't know the whole facts about Guantanamo. The numbers are very, very small. But in the case of the Germans, POWs, we do know that it was a violation of international law, and the treatment was horrific. German civilians were not allowed to even give food or water to many of these German prisoners who were held in these open-air camps, where many succumbed to lack of food, to exposure in the elements, and so forth. But that's just what that was the focus of the book by James Bach, which caused a big furor, was given a lot of attention in the Canadian and somewhat in the American media. We sold the book, too, and I think we still do through the IHR. But on this larger subject, including this aspect of it, is a new book that we've been talking about by a British historian named Giles MacDonagh, apparently a Scottish historian, entitled After the Reich. And it's available through Amazon.com, and it's a review of it appears on our website. But this book is a 600 and, very lengthy book, more than 600 pages. It's entitled After the Reich, The Brutal History of Allied Occupation. And he details, both with documents but more with very startling anecdotes and individual stories, this very little known and suppressed story of great suffering, death, mistreatment of Germans after the war by American, British, and by the Soviet forces and occupation forces after the end of the war. His best estimate of the is that some 3 million Germans, military and civilians, died unnecessarily after the official end of hostilities. That's 3 million after. This is in addition to many Germans who lost their lives through neglect or mistreatment, even while the war was still going on under Allied rule. But this is detailed in this important book, which I said, as I mentioned, is reviewed in our website, but also available through Amazon.com.
That is a book, the review of which I have at Rents.com and would really much like to read at some point. We just don't know, as people, what our own government did, what other governments did to these human beings. They're just, it boggles the mind, Mark.
I think one of the most difficult things is for Americans to accept or understand this, because it means, especially for older Americans, changing many deeply held assumptions about American life. That is, every country, of course, wants to, and every person wants to think well of himself, and we don't like to think badly of ourselves or of our history. But we very often in American history and American life, we are unable to see ourselves in a larger world perspective. And this is very, very difficult for our country because we don't have the same cultural, religious, racial cohesion that other countries do and which they fall back on and rely on in times of crisis. It's our national myths, you might say, which are just about the only thing that holds America together. And that's getting more and more important at a time when our definition as a cultural, religious, racial entity is dissolving more and more with each passing year. Just the other day I was struck that the passports now issued by Americans, if you got a passport in the last few months, just recently the U.S. State Department has been adding little quotations to the American passport from Americans in the past about freedom. And basically it's to remind Americans when they're going overseas, because they need reminding, I guess, that this is a good country and we should support it and America stands for freedom. But other countries don't do that because they don't need to. People in Japan or Norway or Sweden or Russia They knew who they are because they are Russian or Swedish or Japanese or whatever they happen to be. And that's the definition of who they are. This is a country, unlike other countries, and it's defined, at least we'd like to think, or we think it's defined, I guess, by our ideology. And that's a very hard thing to sustain under great when real pressure comes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, World War II is the great defining war because that was a war in which more than any other that we had fought in the past, it was defined as a war for a new world order, for these principles, supposedly, which were it was a fraud, really, because we betrayed the very principles we claimed we were fighting for.
That's true.
Much in the same way that we're now doing in Iraq and the Middle East.
And we might also add, as we get close to a break here, that Hitler, in his later writings, predicted, and he wasn't the only one, you could see, I think, the war was lost in 43, 44, and predicted exactly what we're looking at in Europe today.
Well,
I mean, within reasonable parameters, he predicted it. He called it.
Okay. Well, we can touch on that after the break, I guess.
Yeah, we got a break here.
Okay.
And there's also that famous Churchill quote. Were you able to find that book and check that at all?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute here.
Shall I read that? Shall I read that quote afterwards?
Well, we'll talk about that, I think, yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to take some calls, too, if possible.
All right, we'll give it a shot and see.
Okay.
Okay, and we're back with Mark Weber. Not a lot of time, but the phone number here to call in is 800-259-9231. 1-800-259-9231. So those of you listening live can give a call if you'd like. All right, Mark, go ahead.
Well, we were talking about the goals of Britain and Churchill during the war, and, of course, the United States and the Soviet Union during the war, because the goals of each of these countries were different in many ways. Well, earlier this day, you and I, or yesterday, we were trying to track down a quote attributed to Churchill. Now, I think the one you sent today is, I'm dubious about it, as I wrote to you.
Uh-huh.
But we do have, the essential point that Churchill was making, and he did make this, is that despite the propaganda, Britain was pursuing what they call the balance of power policy to oppose whatever power was dominant on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
But the great tragedy, the great irony of the Second World War is that in 1939, Britain declared war on Germany. By the way, very few people know that. The American history books give the impression that it was Hitler or Germany
Correct.
That declared war on Britain.
Yep.
It was actually just the other way around.
Yep.
But anyway,
yep.
Britain declared war on Germany in 1939 over Poland because Germany had attacked Poland for reasons it's too much to go into right now. But Germany had attacked Poland, even though, of course, virtually simultaneously the Soviet Union also attacked Poland, but Britain declared war only on Germany, not on the Soviet Union. The irony is, and after the end of the war, after this horrific struggle, after all these deaths, Poland was not free. Even at the end of the war, it came under Soviet domination,
yep.
against the will of the Polish people.
Fed to the Bolshevik hordes.
Yes, and at the end of the war, of course, Britain was completely exhausted. Its empire inevitably fell apart after that, so that even when Churchill became president, prime minister of Britain in 1940 and proclaimed that the war is being fought, he said, to preserve the British Empire, and our way of life, that way of life and that empire
mm-hmm.
were inevitably destroyed as a result of the very conflict. And it's very important to understand, and something very hard for Americans to understand, war is not simply a game that one wins. Wars make sense only in terms of what is being fought for. What is the goal in this war? Because the ultimate test is not the military campaign, but the political one. What ultimately comes out of the war? And if a country and a nation and a people are worse off at the end of the war, even though they supposedly win militarily, then the war is really a defeat for that people, not a victory, even though they may feel good.
Right.
Because wars are not football games. They're not struggles in which we go off, fight, and then come back home and everything's normal again. That's the way traditionally it has been in America because our wars have been fought overseas, far, far away from our shores. And that's one of the reasons why other people around the world look at war very differently than Americans do, because wars for the Japanese or the Chinese or the Germans or the Russians are horrific things that happen in their own countries, leading to massive death, suffering, sacrifice, and occupation, defeat in many cases. Some things, these are things that Americans have not undergone and not endured.
Never endured. They have any taste for it. No idea.
The closest thing in American history to this is the fate of the South during the Civil War and the occupation by the North. That's the closest thing, and that's why some Southerners have some understanding of what some of this means.
Right.
But most Americans don't, because especially many Americans, of course, are descended from people who were not even in the United States during the Civil War. But anyway, the larger story that I am trying to emphasize out of all of this isn't to say, well, because the Germans suffered at the end of the war, after the war, that makes them good any more than the notion that because a people or a group suffered during a conflict or in any other way, that makes them morally superior.
That's exactly right.
It's a childish notion.
Of course.
But we're told over and over, Americans are trained to believe that because a group suffered in the past or their ancestors suffered, we should have a special sympathy or a special preferential treatment for that group. That's crazy. Because somebody suffered doesn't make them good, and certainly it's not really relevant to what our own interests and our own outlook must and should be. But anyway, so putting it in that context about World War II is to see the conflict as a great tragedy, a tragedy which in many ways Britain was not a winner, for example, but a loser. And even the Soviet people, the Russians, of course, even though they were winners, they're in many ways losers in
very
that
true.
Conflict,
yeah,
and to
true.
See it in that larger way.
Yeah. Okay. Germany, a shattered country. A lot of people talk about the Marshall Plan, and how benevolent it was and all the rest of it. What was the Marshall Plan in your view, and how did it really play a role in helping the German people?
There's a consensus by all historians. The reason for the Marshall Plan, which was to build up the economy of Europe, although most of the money of the Marshall Plan did not go to Germany, it went even more to Britain and France, but the purpose of the Marshall Plan was to reverse a policy which had been the American policy in the first 2 years after the war. That is to treat Germany very vindictively. But the reason for the change wasn't because of a flowering of humane feelings on the part of the American leaders. It was because of concern over the rising power of the Soviet Union. And it was the feeling that unless Germany and the rest of Europe could be won over mm-hmm. to the American side, mm-hmm. then the danger was it would all become communist. And
that was a very distinct danger, by the way.
Very distinct. The Communist Party was very powerful, very well organized in France and Italy especially,
mm-hmm.
and of course, Germany had, the Soviet Union was occupying parts of Germany and had a very strong movement in place to try to take over the rest of Germany, of course, the rest of Europe, because that's not just a desirable goal for the Soviet Union as a country, it's an integral part of the whole Soviet philosophy, which holds that the entire world should be communist. It's absolutely essential and integral part of the whole Soviet worldview. But anyway, the Marshall Plan, which Americans pat themselves on the back for, wasn't based on some sudden humane consideration. It was based on these power political considerations.
The exigencies of the Cold War had begun to rear in many quarters. The future then became clear that the adversary was Stalin, our former ally, and things had to change.
Well, the larger story is, I think, and we can draw it from this, is that after it was all, in our life, just in the last years, the Soviet Union has fallen apart. And that has changed the whole world situation because from the end of World War II up until the 90s, the world was divided essentially into two large camps, the Soviet camp, including its allies, the communist camp, and the United States. And for the whole world, the choice for all individual countries and people was between these two sides, which side are you going to be on? Now the Soviet Union is gone. There is no communist power really in the world. And so the United States now is looked upon and its policies are looked upon in terms of the interests of the country in a very direct way and not in terms of the Soviet Union. That means that although many people in Europe who might not be happy with aspects of American policy, culturally, politically, and so forth, they sided with America because the alternative was the Soviet Union, which was of course not acceptable anywhere. But that's all changed now. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why around the world there's a growing hostility, distrust, dislike of the United States and its policies, because the United States is still carrying out policies that's rooted in our own ideology and our own way of life that other countries don't like and resent, and which we would resent if they were imposed on us.
You bet. Yep. How goes the overall battle to try to bring real focus to what actually happened before and after World War II, and during it? I mean, during it is okay, but before and after World War II, these periods are not understood by most people.
Well, everybody, there's a lot of talk about, and one of the criticisms we get all the time is people say, you people at the IHR, you're trying to rewrite history. Well, in a sense, that's true. In a sense, we want to make sure that history is as truthful
accurate
as we can make it, and
yes,
accurate. But more than that, after the Soviet Union collapsed, or after communism changed, there was a massive rewriting of history books in those countries. And very few Americans realize how much our own history books have changed over the last 40, 50 years.
The last 10, they're rewriting them all the time.
The last 10 years, that's right. That's right. It's a fascinating subject, and I've read extensively on it, and I've talked about this, to compare how Americans even looked at themselves as reflected in our history books from the 1950s or 60s compared to today.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different world.
Yeah.
And the biggest aspect of it is this. Up until the 1960s, 70s, or so forth, there was a basic assumption about that America is a country defined not just by an idea, but also by certain cultural norms, racial, religious, cultural, and so forth. Now, that has been swept aside. And so the history books today reflect an ideologically confused country in which there is no real definition, in which the founding fathers are bad guys.
Yep.
Columbus is a bad guy, not a good guy.
Yep.
And it's very difficult to see how a generation can be raised with any kind of confidence in its own history or its own future if they're told over and over and over by our leaders, by our teachers, and by our school books that we have all these things to be ashamed of about American history.
Well, they can't.
They can't.
Of course, that's being done with intent and malice aforethought. This is a re-engineering, reformatting of a society, a terraforming of it, if you will, to suit the special interests of the movers and shakers and controllers. It's being done with a great deal of sophistication. They're very clever. They're very effective at it. And it really needs to be opposed.
They're a fascinating parallel between the kind of ideology we have in our history books and in our schools and the kind of ideology that was forced down the people of the Soviet Union when the communist regime was in power. And I hate to say it, and we hate to see it, but we're heading in the same direction as well, because a society cannot hold together just on the basis of these slogans, illusions, or ideology based that's not based in reality.
Indeed. Mark, thank you very much for being here. We'll talk to you again soon, next week, in fact.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks a lot. Good night. Mark Weber, IHR.org. That's our program tonight. We'll be back tomorrow night. See you then.